Now, we look at Genesis 49. Let's remind ourselves where we're at. Okay. We've worked our way now through the life of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's some debate over whether or not Joseph would be considered a patriarch. Probably the strongest argument against Joseph being a patriarch is the fact that he was never really considered to be one of the three primary men who were met by God directly and spoken to of promise. Yes, Joseph's life, as we've seen through the bulk of this study, certainly was blessed by God, and yes, he had a tremendous effect upon Israel as a nation. But he's not really a patriarch. As we come to chapter 49, technically, we're coming to the end of the patriarchs. So we're coming to the end of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you remember, too, that another strong argument against Joseph being a patriarch is that God never references him when he says, I'm the God of Abraham, I'm the God of Jacob. You know, he doesn't include Joseph in that list. Now, again, I'm not making Joseph less valuable. I'm just putting the case in place. So what we're looking at in Genesis 49 is the very last words of this patriarch. In fact, when you get to verse 28 and you move into the final verses of the chapter, you see his death. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the whole issue of the patriarchs closes, and 50 then becomes somewhat of an epilogue in the book, kind of closing the book. Okay, so you will notice your lesson, the way it's written in 31, will deal specifically with it as an epilogue, having you rethink and look at back through some of the things that we've discussed. Okay. But we also have in Genesis 49 something also very interesting, and that is the last will and testament of Jacob. Using the language I would use in today's world, okay, I realize this is not an actual will and testament, but what is Jacob doing? He's transferring a blessing to his sons. Basically, he is, at this point, giving to his sons his worldly possessions, quote unquote. All that he owns. He's giving it to these kids. But he's giving it to them, as you would do in ancient times, with a blessing. A specific statement of who they are and what they are and what they will be, prophetically speaking. I think the Holy Spirit is engaging Jacob to give these words. There's no way you can read this without seeing that, I think. So the idea is that Jacob's coming to the end of his life now, and what you would normally do in a second millennium BC world is you would hand or seed all of your belongings to your sons and place them in their ordinary positions. You would speak to your firstborn son. Now, what would you say to him? You would say, you are my firstborn, you are the one who rightly deserves to be the new leader of the family, so I'm going to cede to you a double portion of the inheritance, and then the other sons would each receive a portion. In some cases, daughters would even be given a part of that as well. So part of that is what you see here. And then, of course, you see the more specifically the words related to each of these 12 sons. Now, of course, we can read this through three millennium of revelation, through three millennium of progressive revelation, right? Because what we know is far greater than what Jacob would have ever known about who the Christ is and God's redemptive plans and purposes in time and space, right? I mean, we have a lot of past eyes to look through here. And we can read this, and we can see something phenomenal here. And what we can see phenomenal here is that this man was prophetic, dare I say, or prescient in his understanding of how Israel was going to look, what was going to come. So the idea being that as Jacob is about to die, I think under the influence of the Spirit of God, he now brings his sons in and says to them, each of you, here's what's going to happen. I'm giving to you now my progeny, all that I have, and I'm also going to speak words over you, and then I'm going to draw up my legs into a fetal position and die. Which is what he does. Okay? So this chapter is extraordinarily important. It really sort of, in a way, establishes what the future of Israel is going to look like. Now let me call something else to your attention. This morning I mentioned the grammatical historical approach of dealing with biblical exegesis. This is an approach in which you ask, as I said, two primary questions. Number one, what did the writer slash author, in this case, speaker, want to say? And what would his audience have heard? That's how we can do a proper exegesis of a text. We're not asking it, what does it say to me living in the second millennium AD? What we're asking is, what did it mean to those listening to the book in the second millennium BC? And who is the audience of this book? The audience of this book are the people descended from these very characters. All of the various tribes of Israel that are awaiting their entry into the promised land, assuming as we do that Moses wrote this book as a part of his wanderings in the wilderness in order to give a historical record to the people before they entered into the promised land so they would understand why this land was important and understand more importantly what their place was going to be in it. And to give them the courage to actually do what they should have done at the beginning, which was go in and take it, he writes this to say to them, you want to know who you are? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you who you are. And let me quote the words of the patriarch himself. Let me share with you what he said about who you are so you will understand your place. Okay? So that's why this becomes important to us. This is a way of us, if you will, looking forward into the history of Israel from someone who had not yet lived it. And remember, let's not forget, when Jacob writes these words, how big is his family at this point?
66.
So 66, 70 people, give or take? That's not a nation. That's barely a clan, right? And so he's saying things that are not going to come to pass until 400 years have passed, until they become a nation. And all those promises that God made to Abraham have been fulfilled. So these are prophetic words, but they're also valuable teaching words, instructive words, correcting words, and the list goes on and on. So we mustn't underestimate what's in here. Okay? Now, let's look at the various people that are in here, and let me draw your attention to a few facts along the way here, okay? As we read through this, you will discover that the son of Jacob that gets the most prominent position in the entire story is Judah, the fourth born son of Jacob. Now, that's unusual because he's not the firstborn. Reuben is the firstborn. And the first words about Reuben are, yes, you are my firstborn. Yes, you are the first fruits of my strength. You are preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power in the sense that you're the firstborn. And from a natural perspective, from a human perspective, you are the one to receive the promises. And I should give you the position. But unfortunately, you're as unstable as water. Now, we know why, of course, right? We remember the story that Reuben himself had taken his father's concubine. And so, in fact, that's exactly what Jacob himself points to. You shall not have preeminence. You have preeminence culturally, but you shall not have preeminence in my blessing or in Israel as a nation because you went up to your father's bed, because you did what is sinful. You lost your position because of your sinfulness. This is echoing of other men in Scripture who had great position and they lost it due to their sinfulness. Saul is a good example of a man who had great position in Israel, the first king, given a great opportunity to lead a nation, chosen specifically by God and set aside, and yet fails to do what God commands him to do, and he is dethroned in favor of another. It's also, it should not escape your attention, of course, that this is not the first time in this book that an eldest son is passed up for a younger. We've seen that at least three times prior to this in this book, have we not? Mm-hmm. Ishmael was passed over for Isaac. Esau was passed over for Jacob himself, now Reuben being passed over for Judah. And I think it's, I don't know, maybe it's just God's sense of humor, but it's almost as though at the very end when Jacob is saying these words to Reuben and thinking about why Reuben doesn't deserve it, it's almost as though Jacob goes, yeah, this is the way it always goes in my family. This is how it works. Okay, I wasn't the firstborn, and you're not going to be anything special either. The longest and most beautiful blessing, as it turns out, goes to Joseph. Mm-hmm. Starts in verse 22 and goes all the way through the end of 26. Says a lot of words about him, but again, that makes sense given the context. Joseph is the one who has just saved his family from the famine. Joseph's the one who was sent ahead by God in a very ordained and sovereign way to protect his family. Jacob, in fact, thought he was dead for many years. But now he's back alive again, and he's saved the family. So he gets a very long blessing here. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. We know who the archers are, right? All the other brothers in the previous verses. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, and so on. He's given a long and beautiful statement of his faithfulness, and specifically the faithfulness of God over him. The shortest blessing is a toss-up. There are three of them that get very short: Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. Although I have, I think it's Gad that's actually the shortest in the Hebrew in verse 19, but I'm not sure of that, so don't hold me to that. Nonetheless, these three sons, sort of middle child syndrome thing here. That really don't get a lot of attention. They're not on the outside edges. They're not really the... But that shouldn't mean to imply that they're not valuable in the history of Israel. It's just that they're, you know, they're not set aside as some particular great part of the blessing. I asked you what the oddest blessing was, and we debated the subject last week. My particular opinion is Naphtali in verse 21. What exactly is meant by a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns? What exactly is it saying? Is that he's a man who has a tremendous sense of beauty, whatever that might be? Maybe he was a handsome son, or maybe he's just very fertile, and Jacob expected the little tribe of Naphtali to be very fertile. I don't know. It doesn't really say, does it? It's just sort of strange. My guess is that it has something to do with the relationship between Jacob and his father, which is sort of an inside understanding between them in some way that Jacob writes down, but we're never told what it really means. You might want to put that on your list of questions to ask when you get there. What did you mean by that, Jacob? Now, as I said a moment ago, Judah gets the most prominent position, but he's the firstborn son, which means that there's three sons prior to him, not just one. I mean, if we're going back to my example earlier, yes, we had, you know, one son over another in two previous examples, but this is a case of one son after three previous ones. But Jacob will give us the reasons why Simeon and Levi will not be considered to take their brother Reuben's position. And the reason he says is because they are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. And you remember the story from our examination of their entry into Shechem when Jacob was returning with his family from his time with Laban, and he re-entered into the promised land and stopped at Shechem, which was a mistake, you remember, but he stopped there, and his daughter Tamar, no, not Tamar, yes, Tamar? Am I got that confused with Dinah? One of them was raped. Yeah. Tamar was raped. Thank you.
Tamar was raped.
You ever have one of those moments where you're going, have I got the name right?
Dana was raped. Tamar was the daughter of Judah.
Correct. Dinah was the raped one.
It was a raped one.
Yes, okay. I knew I had that wrong. Okay. Get all these names mixed up. There's so many names. I know.
No,
you are right. So anyways, after the daughter was raped, you remember the brothers decided to take matters into their own hands. They tricked the town into getting circumcised. And then when they did, and while they're recovering from it, they attack and kill them. So Jacob never gave permission to do that. And so he turns to them and says, you will not have this honor. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. Now, here's the key statement in verse 7. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And you remember that Levi is never actually given specific territory. He is given the blessing of becoming the priesthood for the people of Israel, but only because the Levites were the first to step up at the Golden Calf incident and stand against their brothers who were involved in that. And so they were given the opportunity to become, at that point, the priests. So they never receive a specific plot of land in the division of the land under Joshua. Okay, so they're scattered in Israel. And you remember the Levites had to live in all the various towns and cities, and they had to live off the people and so on. But Simeon is also there as well. If you look carefully at a map of the way that the tribes are dispersed, you will see that Simeon is encased entirely within Judah, in the lower part of Israel. In fact, the lower half of the western side of Israel. Simeon gets a little spot in the middle of Judah. And we know, if you read the Old Testament carefully, that the tribe of Simeon is eventually absorbed into the tribe of Judah. It basically disappears at some point. Yes, Joseph does give it a spot, but it's surrounded by another tribe, which makes it sort of an internal tribe to Judah. And the necessary result of that is over time, it simply gets absorbed as the various people of the tribe of Simeon intermarry with the people of Judah, and they eventually disappear as a specific tribe. By the days of David, the tribe of Simeon is gone. They're not mentioned again. Okay, and that's coming true for this prophecy here. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And notice that Hebrew parallelism that's often found in Hebrew poetry, where Jacob just basically says the same thing twice. I'll divide them in Jacob. I will scatter them in Israel. That's basically saying the same thing. But the idea of saying it twice is to give it a strong sense of importance. If you read the Psalms and you see those kind of duplicate statements like that in Hebrew poetry, it means read that. That's important. It's doubly important. It's being repeated. Same thing here. Okay. So, Reuben's passed over because he was a profligate. Simeon and Levi are passed over because they're men of violence and they violated their father's decrees and so on, which leaves Judah then to come to the place of preeminence. And so, Jacob bestows upon Judah a profound set of blessings, okay? Unlike really any other in the entirety of this chapter. Judah, your brother shall praise you. Okay, that's right off the bat. He puts Judah in a place of preeminence. They will be praised by the rest of their brothers, which means that Judah would become the primary tribe of Israel. And we know this is going to be the case, because even as the history of Israel unfolds, we know that Judah will be the place where the power will be held. And eventually, Judah will be the southern kingdom of Israel entirely when all of the northern tribes, all of the other tribes except Benjamin, are carried off by the Assyrians in 721, 722 BC. Judah's all that's going to be left. Okay, so one is they're going to be sort of the preeminent place. If you remember, the city of Jerusalem, which becomes David's capital, sits on the border between Benjamin and Judah. It's sort of at the midpoint of the western side of the Jordan to become sort of the capital city. But after the nation splits and the northern capital moves to Samaria, then Jerusalem becomes the preeminent city of the southern kingdom entirely. And eventually, as the northern kingdom disappears, Jerusalem once again becomes the capital of Israel, which it is even to this day, contrary to our Muslim friends who believe that it belongs to them. It belongs to the ancient Israelites. It belongs to David. Secondly, he says, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. And I think that's Hebrew parallelism, by the way, as you read that. your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. They will have power over their enemies in an unusual way. The tribe of Judah will spawn a number of warriors who will become the chief power of the nation of Israel. David is going to eventually, as the one who finishes the conquest, remember, what Joshua started in the early days of the entry of Israel into the Promised Land. It's not completed until the days of David. It's not until David hands the keys to a complete nation to his son, Solomon. And so the final act of real power is going to come out of Judah. It's going to come out of David. Okay? So he's going to have a specific, Judah, I should say, is going to be a specific tribe from where the real power of Israel is going to be exerted. You're not going to see it in other places. You could make a very good argument, by the way, that the part of the reason that the northern kingdom fell as it does, go read 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. One of the reasons that the northern kingdom falls is because its military is weak. It has no power against the forces coming from the north. Because it sacrificed a strength of numbers with its southern neighbor, with its southern tribe, to have its way in being a nation unto itself. And in the process of doing so, it put itself on the chopping block. Judah is where the real power of military is going to be. Thirdly, Judah is a lion's cub from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness who dares rouse him. Okay, notice the idea, the picture of a lion here. What does a lion represent in Israelite lore? What is a lion in Israelite lore?
Power.
Power. But more specifically, royal power. The king of the beasts is the royal power. Okay, so this verse leads Jacob into the next statement. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Now, from the history of Israel's perspective, the first king didn't come from the tribe of Judah. Where did Saul come from?
Benjamin.
Okay. Now, there is a connection there in this sense that Benjamin and Judah are so closely connected together. One could make a very good argument that Benjamin is nothing more than an extension of Judah. Remember, Benjamin is the one tribe that remained faithful to Judah when the kingdom split. The first true power then comes out of Benjamin / Judah. Although then we come to the first king of Israel who is from the second king, sorry, who is from the tribe itself. Okay. So David becomes, as a member of Judah, the man to establish this royal authority in Israel. And you could make a pretty good argument that God is actually choosing his royalty from this southern part of Israel where Judah resides. Benjamin, and then below it all of Judah. The royal power is going to be there. There's going to be a sense in which this is going to be where the kings will be. Now, I know there's a whole succession of kings that you can read in those two books I just mentioned from the northern kingdom, right? There's going to be a whole raft of them going down through time when Rehoboam, the idiot son of Solomon, decides to tax his brothers like he ought not to. Jeroboam the first rebels and takes away the entirety of the northern kingdom. And then there's a whole succession of evil kings, one after another. Not one of them is said to be good all the way through until they fall to the Assyrians in 722. Right? So there's no real royal power in any of the northern kingdom, even when the northern kingdom is a nation unto itself. They're never powerful. In fact, they're constantly asking the southern kingdom for help. Hezekiah got himself in all kinds of trouble going to the aid of a northern king.
Mm-hmm.
Big mistake, right? Okay, so in other words, there's a sense in which the royal power will remain in Judah. That's where it's really going to be. But the great promise then is really when you get into 10b. Until tribute comes to him. Okay? That phrase in Hebrew, if you'll notice the ESV footnote there, really could say, until the tribute comes to whom it belongs. Okay? That's another way of translating that. But I think the ESV chooses the word him because it makes it a pronoun singular male or an individual. An individual. A specific individual. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So it turns from the royalty will be in Judah, in a general sense, to that royalty is coming to a single individual. It's coming to a him. In very much the same fashion as you see in Genesis 3, when God speaks to Eve. Or, I'm sorry, God speaks to the serpent and says, the seed of the woman and you will be in constant strife. He will crush your head. You will bruise his heel. Notice the change of perspective. You're going to have struggle with the entire human race until one particular individual becomes the real enemy against you. Same idea here. Yes, royalty is being pictured. But Jacob knows here, I think by the power of the Spirit, he knows, he doesn't understand it, I bet, but he knows that in some way the seed promise that was coming from God's words to the serpent is coming here. This is the seed. Remember, I've talked about the fact that in the Old Testament, when you read through the Old Testament, you get this constant picture of a seed prophecy running through every book. Dr. Walter Kaiser, I think I've mentioned this before, Dr. Walter Kaiser wrote a book several years ago called The Christian and the Old Testament. And basically what he argues in the book is that the only way to understand the Christ is to understand the seed prophecies that run through all the previous books. You're not really going to understand who this Christ is in his role as prophet, priest, and king until you recognize how he is prophesied and how he's pictured in every single book of the Old Testament. And in fact, that's what the book does. It goes through every single book and shows where the seed is in every single book. Well, here's a, I think, a classic example of the seed prophecy. The him, the individual that's going to come from this. Okay. Now, back up to that phrase, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Okay, we could read that, as I said a moment ago, as simply a statement to say there's always going to be royalty in Judah and all the kings are going to come from that. But we can look upon that statement 2,000 years in arrears, right? And we can say, wait a minute, there's something else here. The scepter, as you know, is the staff used by royalty. A king holds a scepter in his hand. It's designed to designate his position of regal imperial power. By the way, I don't know if you've ever seen Queen Elizabeth carry her scepter, but she will every once in a while, especially at particularly official kinds of things. She has her royal scepter. Okay, so Jacob is prophesying that an eventual king of Israel would be established from this tribe and that that royal position would never depart from that tribe. It's what he says. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. And he's using it, if we connect it to the rest of the verse, he's connecting it to an individual is going to carry. The him, of course, as I said, is a reference to the first royal position itself. Possibly a reference to the early Davidic line just to begin with, but more likely a reference to the permanent royal line that's going to be established in that tribe. Established in the one, with a capital O, who would come as a descendant of that tribe. And this is key to the writers of the New Testament. It is imperative for both Matthew and Luke to include genealogies of Jesus, showing the lineage of Jesus, both through his father and his mother, into the line of Judah, and specifically through David's line. Now, Luke will go even further back, all the way back to Adam, to demonstrate that he's from the human line as well, right? He's human in that descendants, but he is established in the line of Judah. So he comes as the Lion of Judah. Remember that phrase? You've heard it before, the Lion of Judah, right? What book is that in? I think it's in the book of Revelation, isn't it? But notice the symbolism, Lion of Judah, Lion, royalty, King, right? Judah. That's why you want us to know it.
Yeah, I need to study it more.
You've studied it more, obviously, yeah. Okay, so the Lion of Judah is this individual who's going to follow from this position. He's going to be the one who's going to come, and he's going to bring the tribute. The tribute's going to come to him, and to him, now get this, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Peoples. Okay? Not tribes. Not the other tribes, but the peoples. What's he referring to? The word peoples means
all.
Nations. Peoples means nations. We talk about it in people groups, but today we use borders to define people groups. Nations. Whole nations will be subject to this particular king. Now we know that David handed over a throne that had the obedience of many nations to him. He had tribute from a number of city-states who were now under his control, and even powers outside of him that had secondary lines of authority to him. The Syrians, for example, the Philistines, not to mention the Egyptians, had a great deal of connection to him and power that he possessed. In fact, I've argued often, have I not, in this book, that Solomon, that when Solomon took the keys of the throne from David, he took the keys of an empire. Mm-hmm. One of the major empires of the Old Testament. Short-lived, unfortunately, because he passed it on to his idiot son. Yeah. So, but nonetheless, an empire. But it was short-lived. It had to be a continuing line to be referred to here. The obedience of the peoples isn't limited to just a few nations around Israel. The peoples of the world is the picture that's in mind here. Okay. So this Judah then is given this kind of reference. There's no way you can read verses 8 through 12 without coming to the realization that what Jacob is talking about here is a tribe which is going to be doubly blessed, okay? The double inheritance kind of idea. The firstborn picture of a son who's going to receive all of the promises of God. And I cannot help but think that as Jacob is saying these words about Judah, that in the back of his mind, maybe in the forefront of his mind, he's thinking to himself, this is where all of those promises that God made to me are going to be fulfilled. This is where they're going to be fulfilled. And remember, the promises we talk about with Jacob are not limited to just, you're going to get a land and there's going to be a whole bunch of people occupying it. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's part of it, and that's certainly important. But that's not really the end of it. Remember? All the nations of the world will be blessed through you. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a huge promise to receive. Abraham got it. It was repeated to Isaac and it was repeated to Jacob. All the nations of the world are going to be blessed through you. And so I can't help but think that Jacob is thinking to himself when he says those words, peoples, that he's saying, yeah, there's going to be someone who's going to come through the tribe of Judah, I don't know when, but somewhere in the future, that's going to be the one to whom all these, through whom all these promises are going to be made. All the nations of the world are going to be blessed through an individual, a hymn that comes through Judah. You can look at verses 11 and 12 and see even, I think, more of this. I think it gets kind of specific here. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of the grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. What is it a picture of? What is that a picture of? A man who takes his donkey, notice the double statement, binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, okay? He's washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. Is it possible that Jacob here is actually saying words that are fulfilled in the very coming of Jesus himself into the city and going to the cross? What did kings normally ride on?
White horses.
They ride on horses. Why?
Regal.
Because they're regal and because they're full of power. You ride horses because horses are full of power. Who rides on a donkey? Someone less. The servants ride on the donkeys. The wives ride on the donkeys, right? Not the king. The king doesn't come in on the donkey. But But Jesus comes into the city on a donkey. It's interesting that binding his foal and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he's going to come as a king in the sense that he's going to come from the royal line. But to get to his position of fully being the king, he has to come in as a servant first. See it? He has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. What? Why would any man take his nice white garments down to the local winery and dip them in a vat of grapes? Is it?
Could be a number of reasons for that.
A number of reasons, such as? Oh, you were being sarcastic. I'm sorry. He wants a red garment. He wants to dye it. But isn't it a picture of something? It's not clean anymore, is it? Now it's been stained. Now it has a stain. So now it doesn't, it's not, the king rides in on the regal royal thrones. The regal with the on the horse, and what color robes does he wear? Well, sometimes, but he wears purple very often. Purple is the royal color. It was even in this day, by the way. And you know where purple came from originally? It came from the mollusks that were excavated at the sea by the Philistines and the Phoenicians. So they were well versed in this idea of purple being a regal color. They understood this already. But this isn't washing it in such a way as to become now somehow regal. Notice the less nature of this. It's blood of grapes, meaning it's got this purple hue, but it's not the robes of a king. It's the robes of someone else, someone who has gone through something. Now, I again, given the progressive revelation, we know what it is, right? He has to come, he has to suffer through the cross, he has to live in this world as we do and deal with all the realities of life, and then he has to go to the cross. So he has to dip his garments in the realities of life.
A poor man's
garment.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what he has. And then he has the strength that his eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. And by the way, that's so very Middle Eastern. Okay. Jesus is not a Caucasian. All right. Let's make sure we understand that. All right. Okay. All right. I know there's a whole lot of people who believe that, but.
Can I get rid of that picture?
What's that? He has blonde hair and blue eyed? No. Probably not. No, he was Middle Eastern. Okay. His eyes are darker than wine. His teeth are whiter than milk. He has a natural affinity to a people there. He belongs to a specific people. He's not coming as a king on a throne, on a white horse with royal regal robes. He has to come first as a servant. Mm-hmm. He has to come in and look like all of us do, or like Semitic people do from Jacob's perspective, right? Because that's how Semitic people would look. Mm-hmm. Dark eyes, dark hair, and their teeth would be white against a very dark, pale, a dark skin, right? African, Mediterranean. If you've ever met Mediterranean people, you know they have dark olive skin. Okay, that's the picture of it. He's a man who's coming in. He's a man. Okay, he's not some sort of god or demigod. He's a man, looks like one of us, but he's got to come in, and he's got to come in as a servant instead. Now, Jacob, I don't think, had a clue what he was saying in those two verses. I really don't. I don't think he had a clue. But we do. We can see what it says. We can see the prophetic utterance of God in these words as Jesus himself. I think it's possible that Jesus himself may have been thinking of these exact words when he went, told his disciples, go get that donkey and bring it to me, and I'll ride into the city on it. I'll fulfill, if you will, this grand prophecy. Now, we know it's repeated in the Old Testament, so there's other prophecies that are similar to it. But it's right here at the very beginning. Now, I have said, pause here for a moment, I have said again and again and again, have I not, as we've studied this book, that the gospel of Jesus Christ is visible in every chapter of this book. Right? I've been trying to make the case that you can find the gospel of Jesus Christ in every single chapter. Assuming, of course, we understand what the gospel is, all right? I mean, there's a whole lot of people that don't know what it is, but I mean, if we understand the gospel to be the message that the Christ, the Son of God, has come into the world in order to satisfy the demands of God over a people that he knows, in order to redeem them and bring them to God, that's the message, right? Then here it is. Is it not? Mm-hmm. Is it not here? The royal one who will come as a lion, who will have the scepter and the ruler's staff, but before he can come as this king, he must come as this man, and he must come as this servant, and he must not come in some royal regal place, but he must come as a suffering servant first. That's the message of the gospel, is it not? It's the message of the one, capital O, one, who's going to come, and he is going to be a king, but before he can be a king, he has to be a priest. He has to be a priest. Now, this is 400 years before the priesthood, of course, when Jacob says these words, so, yeah, I get it. Jacob's not able to flesh that out anymore, but we can. Say it. In the course of blessing his own sons with what's going to happen in Israel, and Moses writing this to the people of Israel and telling them about what's going to happen as the seed comes, Moses and Jacob are laying the table in front of the Israelites and saying, listen, do you not understand that the redemptive plan of God is coming through you? So stand up and go do what you've been commanded to do, because the Messiah is coming through you. And I've often thought to myself that one of the first clues that the Israelites should have had that the law could not save them are passages just like this. Because what they should have said is, when the law was given and God gave all these commands and restrictions, and what did they say every time? Yes, we will do them. We and our children will do them. And then what are they doing? Not. Okay? But you kind of look at this and you think, if these people would have half a sense, they would have gathered around and they said, you remember what Jacob said? Jacob said that there's someone coming to be our rescuer. Remember, he wrote in Genesis a number of times about this idea of someone who was going to be coming, who was going to rescue us. He didn't say something. He said someone. So, we can look at this law and we can say, yeah, this is good, God, and we're glad you've given us this law, because it certainly does entail what you expect of us. And yes, it certainly entails what it means to be in right relationship with you. But you know what, God? Two truths stand out to me here. Number one, this law you've given me, ain't no way in the world I can do it. And then secondly, I'm going to need something more than that law, aren't I? Since I can't be saved by it. What am I going to need? The seed.
But the arrogance of man.
Well, of course.
In our works. Of
I know.
Like, look it up. Just tell me what to do, and I'll do it.
Yes. Now, I realize I'm being completely hypothetical here. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the people of Israel missed this prophecy, as with so many others in this book, in regards to the fact that God wasn't promising to send them a law. God was promising to send them a one.
And the prophets.
And the prophets spoke to it. Yeah, right, right. Time after time after time, God kept sending the same message to him and saying, okay, here's the deal, right? Here's the deal. Quickly, we've still got a few minutes yet. I had you locate where the various tribes are located, and to see some of the things about these various tribes. And I realized that my Bible doesn't even have a map of the tribes of Israel in it, which I thought was rather bizarre. I would have assumed that that would have been one of the first maps that would be in this Bible. I even went out and bought a new one, and it ain't in there. It's strange.
That's so Old Testament.
I know. I'm sorry. I know. Actually read the Old Testament. Who reads the Old Testament anymore? So I had to go online and find one. Okay. Now, what you have, of course, if you remember, is you have a nation that's divided into four geographical zones. Remember? Right? First zone is the zone to the sea. That's the coastal plains. The people of Philistia and the Phoenicians in the north lived along that coastal zone. And then as you move inland, as you move to the east, you come to the
plains.
Well, that's the coastal plains, but as you move in east, what you come to is the second main zone. You come to the hill country. You come to that ridge, that spine that runs up and down through the middle of Israel. It's not very big mountains. They're just hills. I mean, compared to the hills of Birmingham. I mean, the mountains in Birmingham, they're actually just little hills. But they're a spine that runs north and south, probably about 50 miles in from the Jordan River. Okay, and then you go to the third zone, which is the Jordan Valley. Okay, so now you go down the other side of those hills and you come to the Jordan Valley, which separates the western side from the eastern side of Israel itself. And then, of course, you have on the other side, what we call the Transjordan, you have the eastern part of Israel. Okay, and the various tribes are located in all these areas. Their exact boundaries are unknown to us today. Most Bible maps that you have are just taking a guess as to about where they are, give or take. And if your Bible map is of any good, you'll also notice that the nations of the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites are also fixed around the outside, and the Philistines internally to the east of Judah along the sea, where Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza are. Okay, today the Gaza Strip is that section where ancient Gaza used to be along the edge of Israel in that day. All right, and I just had you look at where these various little tribes are located. Really, the most significant ones in the group, of course, are Judah to the south, Benjamin sitting on top of it. Manasseh, if you remember, is divided into two halves, the half-tribe of Judah on one side, which takes up basically the entire Jordan River's length all the way to the sea from the north to the south. And then you have Manasseh, the other half of Manasseh, on the eastern side. And this, I think, is a part of what eventually comes as the sons of Joseph are given their spots. Because remember, Ephraim and Manasseh are the two sons of Joseph. Joseph himself doesn't get a specific territory. It's divided amongst his two sons. And I think that's a blessing upon him for that. Also on the other side are Gad and Reuben. You'll notice Reuben is on the south of the Dead Sea, or the north end of the Dead Sea on the eastern side, the southern end of the eastern part of Israel. I think part of the reason for that is simply a judgment. Reuben doesn't get a nice, comfortable spot located in the center of the main part of Israel. They get stuck over in the desert area to the eastern side of the Jordan, which is largely desert over there.
And they're separated from the rest of the
tribe. And they're separated from the rest of the tribe, which makes them fair game for the Ammonites and the Moabites, which, as you remember, is part of their history, which becomes part of their history. And then you take Zebulun, it's kind of stuck in there up at the top. Issachar gets a little spot along the Jordan River up to the north. Asher gets the sea territory where Tyre is, Naphtali, to the interior of that along the section running south along that river there. I'm not sure what that river is. I forget. It's just a tributary of something, but to the north. And you remember that everything from Dan in the south, Dan in the north and Beersheba in the south becomes the entirety of what's described as Israel. Beersheba, as you can see on your map, is located within the confines of Simeon, well to the south, just above the wilderness of Zin, which is a territory that nobody lives in, because again, it's just desert area there. So from Dan to Beersheba is the north-south run of that. And in some ways, the way that Jacob speaks of Zebulun and Issachar and Dan and Gad and Asher and Naphtali kind of fits with this territory list and the way it looks here. Not always exactly, but it's close enough that you can make some pretty good arguments for where these various peoples are located and why. Zebulun is established as a small territory in the center of the land, west of the Sea of Galilee. Although it's landlocked, the tribe was situated on the trade routes between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean, and they were often referred to as involved in coastal commerce. So where Zebulun says Zebulun should dwell at the shore of the sea, it may not necessarily be referring to the Mediterranean. There's another sea. It's called the Sea of Galilee. So the idea is that there's some connection between Jacob's other words here and how it was actually carried out. Okay, and then of course, as I said, the Joseph gets the longest and greatest of these blessings, and it's clear as you read through these that Jacob was a man who persevered through difficult times. He struggled against his brothers. He struggled against Potiphar. He struggled against his jailing. He struggled against even Pharaoh. And he was faithful through all of that, which leads us to Benjamin at the end. 27. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf in the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening, dividing the spoils. Seems like a strange statement for Jacob to make of a son he really loved. Why would he say that? About a son that he really loves, right? A ravenous wolf in the morning, devouring the prey, at evening dividing the spoil. In fact, there's some parallel between verse 27 and what Jacob says about Simeon and Levi in verse 5. Violence, devouring the prey, etc. The best answer that I've heard as to why Jacob is so negative in regards to Benjamin is because Benjamin as a tribe is going to be somewhat inauspicious. As I've said a number of times, Benjamin and Judah are connected at the hip, right? The first true king of Israel comes from Benjamin, followed by the second king, David, who comes after him from the tribe of Judah. It's very possible that what Jacob is actually saying here is that Benjamin is in some ways, based on where it's situated, going to be the front door to the north against the various raiders that will attempt to come into Judah from the north. If you look at the map and you see Benjamin basically covering the top of Judah as though it's sort of a buffer between Judah to the south. It's very possible that what Jacob is simply referring to here is the idea that he's going to be the one that's going to be involved in the same kind of protection and military strength that Judah will be. Being connected together as they were in the southern kingdom, that seems to make sense historically. And I think that's a pretty good explanation. On the other hand, it could just very well be that nobody knows.
Like the front line of defense.
Front line of defense, yeah. Because remember, the vast majority of invading armies, as it turns out, if you read your history of Israel closely, all come from the north. Mm-hmm. They're not going to come from the east because no one's going to trek across 2,000 miles of desert to get from the Euphrates to the Jordan, except Abraham, but he went over the top, right, through Assyria. So no one's going to come from the east. You can't come from the west because there's a really big body of water there. Now, there was some seagoing activity. The Phoenicians were already on the waters by this time. So it's possible that they could have come by boat. But they're not going to come in numbers great enough to be able to conquer a land force. Hmm. Not in those days. Okay. And even technically in our days, you're not really going to either. Okay. So the fact is that there's nothing going to come from the east or west, and there's really nothing going to come from the south either, although the Egyptians will come. Remember, they're going to come from around the bottom of the Mediterranean there at the corner, but they're not going to be that big of a problem over time. The real problem is going to be from the north. It's going to be from the Syrians, and then the Assyrians, and then the Babylonians that are going to come across the top, and then the Persians that are going to come all the way across the top, and then the Greeks that are going to come from the top. Everybody comes from the top. In fact, what's interesting is that if you listen to some of the deep fundamentalists who believe that that Gog and Magog is actually coming from Russia, guess where it's coming from?
Over the top.
From the north, again, right?
Turkey.
Yeah. So, in other words, it's always from the north. So I think that picture gives you this picture of a buffer coming down from the north to protect, being thrown into Judah. Go ahead.
No.
Yeah.
Would you put a map on a globe?
Yep.
Like the Earth is a globe.
Mm-hmm.
Due north is not Moscow.
No, it's not Moscow.
Mm-mm. That's what they were.
Yeah.
No, it's not. But it's over And it would come, any invading army is going to have to come from the north in this day. Any, you know, I mean, today it can come from any direction.
No, I know.
But the idea being that the north is the preeminent place of where real attack is going to come. And Solomon pretty much had control of the south, right? I mean, he ruled basically everything from the Nile to the Indian Ocean along the African continent. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Queen of Sheba came from deep in the south to come up and visit him, and he owned the territory to the south, First and Second Kings, if you don't believe me. Okay, so in other words, Benjamin seems to be positioned in this place, and I think for me that's always been the best explanation as to why Jacob says what he does about this little tribe, and it, you know, it kind of loses its position. Then we come to the last verses of the chapter. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with a blessing suitable to him. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they also buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. And then when he finished his commands, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and died. Or was gathered to his people, the euphemism goes. But notice, Jacob is concerned, I want to be buried in the same plot with my father, with my father's father, My great-grandmother, I want to be buried with my wife, not the one that I really loved. I buried her by the side of the road somewhere, but with my, you know, the other wife that I think really loved a great deal, had a number of boys with. I want to be buried there. Why?
Represents a covenant family.
It represents stability. This is where we belong. And I think it's interesting that he commands them to do this, okay? He doesn't say, hey, if you want, do this. No, bury me there, because this is our land. Why does Moses include this narrative in the text? Again, using the grammatical historical approach, why does he include this? Because the Israelites are reading it, and because what do they need to hear? That land is yours. Go get it. Mm-hmm. Joshua and Caleb said you can take it, but you wimped out. Because you were afraid, and you didn't go in. And now we've had to wander around the wilderness for 40 years while an entire generation dies. Get in there. It's your land. Go bury Joseph there. And bury your own dead in the land. It's your land. Go live it. This is a promise that God made to me. So in a sense, when Jacob gives this much detail of why this plot is important, I think he does so because he's saying to the sons, and then by extension the Israelites that will come from them, come back. This is the land. This is it. This is where you're supposed to be. This is where you're supposed to be. By the way, where was Jacob when he died?
He was in Egypt.
He's in Egypt. He's not in Canaan. He went with the sons, you remember, to Egypt, and we have every reason to believe that chapter 49 follows after chapter 48 in which Jacob was in Egypt. He died in Egypt. And we know that because I think chapter 50 says they take his body and bring it back. So the idea is Jacob says, don't leave me here. Don't bury me here.
These pagans.
Well, not just that, but don't start a tradition.
Right.
Where you start a new cemetery with my body in it, and then you just get lazy and start burying yourselves here, and then you decide to stay here. No. Take me back, put me in the cave at Mamre, so that later, when you think of me, you'll think of me over here, and this is what you'll be thinking of. Well, that way, from Egypt, right? Okay? So that's why he gives this command to his sons. Go back to this land. I've just told you what all this land is about and how you are going to be blessed sons and how God is going to take this promise that he's given to me and give it to you. So go back to this land. I'm going to die now. And I'm going to be gathered to my people, which means I'm going to see Abraham and Isaac. But you need to take my body and put it in the dust of the ground back where it belongs, because it means something. It means something. Okay? So those are the final words of the patriarchs. Plural. Final words of the patriarchs. Most of this book, as you know, is about the patriarchs, of course. And it's about these men who were given these great promises of God that we now see fulfilled, of course, in Jesus, who has come to complete all these prophecies and bring the gospel to us. All right? So I hope that's helpful to you and that you'll be considering those things as you work on your lesson number 30 for next week. If you don't have a copy, it's up there on the...
31.
Sorry, 31. It's up there on the up on the thing.